So my name is Amy Todd, and I've been researching the topic of women and peace for my public history MA, which I study at Birkbeck College. Today I've invited Pat Gaffney and Liz Khan to discuss the topic, their experiences, and the topic of women and peacemaking today. Pat, would you mind introducing yourself and talking a bit about how you got involved with women and peacemaking?
Sure. My name's Pat Gaffney. For the last 29 years, I've been the coordinator of the work of Pax Christi, which is an international Catholic movement for peace. But I guess my involvement for peace goes further back, probably to the late 70s, when I was involved locally in a peace and justice group. And we were looking then at the special session on disarmament that was being prepared for in New York. And we were trying to kind of raise public awareness about our connections with what was going to be going on there. And that really kind of started my official journey in the peace movement.
Hi, I'm Liz Khan, and I'm a member of Women in Black London. My involvement in the peace movement probably began at Greenham Common. I went up with my work, a group of women, and gradually, in the December, the great big linking arms around the base, and by March had become involved in a local women's group that was then affiliated and going up to Greenham on a regular basis.
So I've got some kind of questions that we'll be talking through, but as we go, if you've got any kind of experiences that you think are relevant or any thoughts, I don't want to kind of guide the whole conversation, so please feel free to chip in. I might just mention this, what you mentioned about Greenham Common. What was that experience like for you? And can you think of what was your reason for going? Was your reason for going being part of a kind of women's movement, or was it more based on non-violence?
I think the reason I went initially was that there was a call for as many women as possible to go to Greenham Common. And to be honest, I think I was very naive. I didn't really know what Greenham Common was. So the solidarity was about going up and joining other women. Mm. I was then working in a feminist childcare organisation that was really promoting women and equality for children with and without disabilities. That was how I first got interested. So when I first went up, I don't think I really understood what it was I was going to become very involved in my life. But it was something that as you began to understand what evil this could potentially bring to our world, it was something that I really felt that I couldn't not participate in. I think it's that thing about even if all I can do is witness and protest, that's important than just being silent and going along with something that I don't agree with.
Mm. It's interesting that you mentioned that you were involved in this kind of feminist childcare organisation and you went to Greenham. When I've done some research about Greenham, kind of as it evolves, you've got women that are coming and are very concerned about their child's safety and things like that. Then you start to get a bit later kind of other groups of feminists and lesbian groups that are a bit more interested in themselves. And there becomes this kind of conflict from what I've seen of whether we should be doing this non-violence and peace work for the sake of our children or for ourselves. Did you feel any of that kind of conflict?
What I found was that I grew as a person, I grew as a woman. I went up there probably because of my children and because of the work I was involved in. But I hadn't really, apart from work, I'd never really been involved in women's politics. I wasn't aware that I was involved in women's politics. Mm-hmm. And I think that's very different because I was. But it gave me opportunities to learn and to sort of see bigger pictures and begin to understand about military bases and what they were there for. And I think before then, I wouldn't have questioned it. Mm. And I think that I then became part of a women's group in Hackney. So that was like an affinity group of about 12 of us. that would go up regularly and become involved in actions. So that was it was that we met regularly, we shared, we talked about what our fears were. And I just feel that was such a huge learning experience that had a huge knock-on effect. If I think of how I grew up very innocent in terms of the world around me, to what I became by the time I was in my late 20s, it was very different. And I think that there was conflict at Greenham. Why wouldn't there be within any community? So there was the early conflict of when men were asked not to stay. For some women, they felt that they were betraying the men in their lives or their sons in their lives. And for other women, it became the opportunity to start making decisions for themselves rather than being in a supporting role. And I think what's important is being able to work through those difficulties. I had a really good example today. I was at work where a 17-year-old hitting back, he sort of said, oh, well, if somebody hits me, I've got to hit them back twice as hard. And I thought about that, and I thought what was really difficult was us talking through the difficulties. We didn't always agree, and sometimes you had to go to a different gate because you couldn't agree with the women at that particular gate, you know, that they couldn't sit. But there was space to do that, and there was space to grow. And I think that's what was really important for me, and it's the reason I've gone on and remain in the peace movement.
Thank you.
Look, I just pick up, and I suppose I would go to Greenham, but more on a sort of solidarity support basis, not living there. And I guess one of the things that the Greenham experience clarified for me was the connection between women and militarism, or highlighted that connection. Looking at the way women were being treated down there because of their resistance to the militarism of the base and the whole military kind of structure coming back on them, and that was enforced by the police structure and then the community structure. But then I was also working in development work at that time and becoming very alerted, really, to the global impact of militarism on women, and, you know, the story of the Kumput women in Korea and women in Japan and women in Vietnam and women in Thailand where there were military bases, and suddenly kind of these things clicking in my head that, gosh, there's a major connection here between the exploitation of women and militarism. And it was on our doorstep, but I was also seeing it in a global context. Mm. So for me, peace work and nonviolence has always been globally political, not just personal. And different experiences kind of reinforce that. But certainly I would, you know, concur with what you were saying about the green experience.
I think also, I just wanted to add, I think also as time went on and women didn't leave Greenham, that the press then brought in a lot of, you know, that they were dirty, they were smelly, they weren't behaving like women should behave. You know, local shops or pubs didn't want them going in because, you know, they'd bring the smell of smoke. But also the whole thing around it being lesbians, I think, was to put off a lot of women who might want to have got involved. But it also meant that there was a space where being a lesbian was okay in society. But I do think that was part of the bad press, that if you went down there, you became a dirty, smelly lesbian. Mm.
And Pat, on the topic of kind of anti-militarism, you mentioned that you were involved with Forces Watch. Do you want to talk a little bit about the work that you do there?
Yeah, well, I'm a trustee of Forces Watch, which is really looking at the impact of militarisation on young people's lives and the responsibility of the military towards young people. And, I mean, I just feel the work is very important because it's very rarely challenge the access that the military have to our schools, to our young people, and particularly to the most vulnerable people in our society, areas of high unemployment, areas of poor achievement. And it, as a former teacher as well, it just seems to me very poor that there's this unquestioning access that the military have, and yet those of us involved in peace education, as I have been for years, or development education about the Global South, find it very difficult to gain access to those environments. So I just feel that at the moment, the military is particularly trying to target again young people. It has very sophisticated advertising programs, its language, the huge amounts of money going into its work with schools and with young people. And I just feel there's a huge dishonesty there, and it's doing young people a great disservice. And yet it's like a holy cow. It's something that when you begin to challenge it, when you talk about it, when you articulate it, there's an enormous pushback, because a military culture is just so accepted in our society.
Liz, you mentioned a bit about being on the receiving end of that negative talk when you do your Women in Black vigil. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
We actually sort of have a lot of positive input as well. So people sort of saying well done, or people coming and wanting to talk to us about the particular subject, or sharing that they're also in a peace group somewhere in the world. But we also have a lot of negativity, like what would we do? You know, what would our solution be then? Or go and live in a country where, you know, go to Russia and see what it's like to live there. And this is democracy, supporting our arms trade. Also, young men, but we've got a lot of young homeless men that have been in the armed forces in the West End, which is where we meet. And they're quite mixed. I mean, one that they feel quite isolated and deserted, having fought for this country, and now left in this sort of dire situation. And others who are still involved in armed forces actually sort of feeling that we're betraying them. We should be supporting them, the armed forces. So it's quite a mixture of responses. But I would say on the whole, we get more positive responses than negative ones, apart from when we're doing our Israel and Palestine vigil. And then what you have is the whole conflict around, are we being anti-Semitic? Are we supporting Palestinians? Don't we? So that's different, because sometimes people have experienced personal loss. And I think it's being really important that we say that we're not condoning the violence on either side, but that there is a real imbalance of power.
Through the research that I've been doing, I hope it doesn't sound a kind of two-dimensional way of explaining it, but obviously when it comes to pacifism and non-violence, it's very much a spectrum. And I think we've spoken a lot about Greenland, but for me, it's a very good example of you've got so many different women coming together, and they might themselves have many different feminisms and feel like there's some parts of some feminist ideology that they agree with and some that they don't, just like with pacifism and non-violence. And so you've got this spectrum of kind of absolute pacifism, and there's, you know, women that maybe would have been violent towards police officers and they're okay with using that violence. But then there'd be other people that maybe go to kind of just war theory, whereas, you know, if they feel like it's okay to be violent. Where do you personally sit on that spectrum, and how does that kind of inform the work that you do?
I think for myself, over the years, I've moved towards using and wanting to enforce the language of non-violence rather than pacifism, because for me, non-violence implies a dynamic and an engagement and something that's moving. Rather, I think that the connotation of pacifism is passive and non-engaging. And I find the challenge of non-violence really invigorating, because it makes me look at every aspect of my life, relationships, economic, social, political, and how I engage in those relationships, and whether they diminish or destroy and dehumanize people, or whether they uplift people. And that, to me, is the kind of peacemaking I want to be involved in. And so I see the language of nonviolence, the practice of nonviolence, as something very active, something very dynamic, something that we build on, something that's inclusive, something that's not absolute and doesn't close doors, but still conveys a very clear value that the use of violence, wherever it is, does not bring about effective, fruitful change.
And I would agree. I remember being at Greenham when we really struggled with cutting the fence because we saw that as some violence. But actually, the more we went, actually, the more we realised that we could destroy property, property that we felt was harbouring evil. So I completely agree with that, that it's non-violence, it isn't pacifism. And I know that I wouldn't be a pacifist if my children's lives were threatened. I couldn't. I know I've got that in me, but I really have to... I find that working in a non-violent way, taking direct action, whether that's lying in the road in concrete, blockading military vehicles, I would do that, and I have no problem in doing that. But I wouldn't, I will resist arrest, but I wouldn't be violent to another person. So the police I'll talk to, but I would never respond violently.
And I just want to ask a bit now about kind of historical practice within the theme of Women and Peace. Have either of you been involved with recording these histories? And if so, do you have any good experiences or projects that you might have been involved in to kind of record these histories?
I suppose it's more contemporary histories, you know. So within my work in Pax Christi, our own story, the fact that we were founded by a woman in 1945, to me is a very important place to start. And to use that, as we do in our education work in Pax Christi, to begin to explore what motivates, what challenges, what helps people get movements off the ground, that's been important. And also looking at the lives of, I have been very inspired by other women of faith. Dorothy Day, the Catholic worker movement in the United States that was both social justice and peace and nonviolence work. The history of many women's religious orders were extremely radical in their time. Women working in a context where to be independent, to be educated, to be offering education to other women, to be living free of men, was very countercultural, and many of those women's foundations, which still exist today, have offered education globally to women and have created tremendous pathways of change. So I do feel that there is, you know, that whatever our tradition is, from a faith or a social, or to explore and to dig into that tradition is really important, because the origins of things help us understand, you know, what things can help and hinder our work in the current context.
I mean, one of the reasons for me wanting to do this project was that I felt that the history of women in peace wasn't recorded enough. Mm. So there is quite a lot of texts about kind of the history of the peace movement in the UK, but none of them have ever really spoken about the Women's Peace Crusade, which speaks to me as coming from a working class background, was, you know, wow, these women in these, you know, they've got enough to deal with having to look after their kids and they can't afford rent. And they're deciding to take this stance, you know, nationally. Liz, is that something that speaks to you as well?
I suppose we've realised how there is very, well, we have a website, a Women in Black website, where women from around the world add things to it. But actually, that's one of the things that's really missing, is not a complete story, because it's always evolving. But there is somebody who is working on writing a book at the moment, trying to incorporate sort of how Women in Black started. I've been involved in a film when I was in Israel. So it's Women in Black by Donna Bailey, and also a radio program, and then sort of different magazines or papers picked it up at the time, because it was sort of seen as extraordinary that these older women were going to Israel and Palestine and protesting. But I have, it's minimal, I suppose. It's looking very much at Women in Black. and our involvement rather than the bigger women's peace movement.
You focused quite a bit there, Pat, about education and thinking and feeling that that's an important thing to be able to educate people. I mean, something that shocked me, you know, I was never taught about pacifism, you know, conscientious objectors, or really kind of women-led movements at school, you know. And I didn't study history when I was younger, but I then went on to teach history and, you know, it's not on the curriculum. And I think, for me, it really resonated that, you know, these women were leading movements and, you know, like you said, being quite countercultural and stuff. And I think that, you know, education could be an approach there to, I think it's an important history that does need telling. Because, like I mentioned earlier, since researching on this project, I've attended a Pax Christi conference. I'm looking to go to a Women's Black Vigil shortly. And I've also got involved with the Women's International League of Peace and Freedom and helping them research delegates that went to the 1919 conference at The Hague. And these were women, you know, coming together to an international platform at The Hague and meet other women across Europe and talk about the, you know, why they should protest against anti-militarism, why the Treaty of Versailles was so terrible and it meant that, you know, that there was going to inevitably be more war. It just really struck me at the Pax Christi conference to do an awful lot of work about peace education and Ashton does. What kind of, do you want to talk a little bit more about that work?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, I think I mentioned I was originally a teacher, so education for peace and social justice is always important to me, and in Pax Christi for over 40 years it's been a strand of the work. And I do feel that we have great opportunities to try and work with teachers to use the curriculum to weave into it this global perspective on issues of peace and social justice, and to look at choices that people have to make, so to look at conscientious objection through the lens of choice, to look at the role of women peacemakers, as we've had the great opportunity to do since 2014 with the kind of whole kind of centenary work around the First World War. And I've done a number of workshops in schools around that, focusing on women peacemakers. And it's been amazing, eye-opening for me, but also for teachers and students to suddenly become aware that there's this whole body of people who were making, as you said, connections between social justice, poverty, militarism, what was going on, employment at that time, and to draw parallels with today. So, again, because I come from a faith background, I feel we need to be even more challenging of faith schools to be raising these issues in the curriculum, because they are very much to do with core values of many of our faith traditions: justice, peace, integrity of the human being. And, you know, education for peace should therefore be central in this work.
And education for children, it's very patriarchy. You know, if you think of, you study kings, you study Second World War, you very rarely, and it's white, so it's a white history. So I think the fact that women very rarely are mentioned, and people of colour are completely invisible.
I just wanted to, I think we're kind of coming to the end now, but one of the questions that I had, you know, before I started this research, myself, I was quite ignorant to kind of women and peacemaking, and now I'm starting to get a bit more involved in it. I can see there's a plethora of organisations doing all these amazing things and working, you know, in very different ways, some more active, some more passive, and, you know, using many different methods to try and achieve kind of peacemaking as women. And I just wanted to ask, what are the things that you wish that people knew about women and peacemaking, or what are things that, you know, women or organisations and ask histories and stories that aren't told that should be? Or are there any kind of myths that you'd like to kind of debunk around the subject?
I think for us, one of the things that we look at is, on all of our vigils, is how militarism or war or violence actually has an effect on women. you know, we sort of know that when you go on the big marches, that everybody has exactly the same placard. They're all sort of saying no to this. And I think that on the vigils, we're always trying to look at what is women's experience, whether they're the ones that have lost their parents, lost their partners, have the children, have lost their homes. They're the ones that are trying, you know, they're the ones that that experience mainly sexual assaults. So we always try and think very seriously about what women's experience has been.
I guess for me, one of the things I would want to convey is the kind of the global story of women peacemakers, because I'm part of an international movement. And I think to get across the sense that, you know, one meets women in East Timor or Kenya or Palestine who are in their own context, are peacemakers in the family or the community or in a national context. And It's to get away from the idea that, you know, people globally are just victims of violence and victims of other people's decision making, but that there is a wealth of experience, there are stories to be shared and stories to be lifted up that can be part of this new history that, you're trying to create with, the historical stuff that you're gathering, that we, begin to get this base of stories here now of how women are change makers, using nonviolence, using education, building on their skills to create better environments now in this world that we're living in, and doing it amazingly creatively and in contexts very different to our own, without the resources that we have, with often far greater challenges of patriarchy and militarism, and yet amazingly, bravely and nonviolently challenging those systems.
Thank you. I think I'll just finish off by saying that one of the kind of key themes that I found through researching women and peace from kind of 1840 to present day through my research has been this conflict between women's rights and women's issues and representation and pacifism or nonviolence, and whether they can kind of come together and work together. Can you take an engendered approach to kind of nonviolence? Why would you do that, you know, and can that be successful? You know, through looking at these movements, women have always had these issues of, you know, childcare, equal pay and things like that, and going further back, issues of, you know, fighting for the vote to right, the right to vote and things like that. And so it's always kind of, the conflict has always kind of been, well, there's other things that we should focus on. And I think that talking to you today about the way that you, your experiences and the way that you approach it, has started the conversation further for me about how feminism and pacifism and women, they really work together. And I think that's where I'll probably kind of take this research next. So I will be releasing 3 blogs after this podcast too, to talk about and highlight 3 key women and through Women and Peace in the UK and their stories. Thank you so much, Liz and Pat, for talking and sharing your experiences.
Thank you. Thanks, Hannah.